Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Saturday, May 14th, a self-described white supremacist drove 3 hours to Buffalo, New York, and murdered 10 black people at the Tops grocery store. The 18-year-old researched zip codes with a high percentage of black residents. Three-quarters of black people in the United States are worried that they or someone they love will be attacked because of their race. This is according to a nationwide Washington Post Ipsos poll conducted right after the shooting. Even before the shooting, in earlier polls, black people saw racism as one of their greatest threats. 65% of the over 8,000 hate crimes reported in 2020 were based on race, ethnicity, or ancestry bias. And within that category, black Americans made up more than half of the victims. The Uvalde, Texas school massacre that left 19 children and 2 teachers dead, almost all Latino, has opened old wounds for those affected by the El Paso massacre that left 23 people dead and over 24 injured. On August 13th, 2019, a Texas man drove 700 miles to specifically target Latinos. In a document, he railed against immigration and, like the Buffalo shooter, embraced the racist Great Replacement theory. Under the Trump administration, the rise in reports of hate crimes against Latinos reached an all-time high. On March 16, 2021, a white gunman entered 3 spas in the Atlanta area and killed 8 people, including 6 Asian American women. Hate crimes and violence against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders remain a very serious issue, according to Stop AAPI Hate. From 2020 to December 2021, almost 11,000 hate incidents against the AAPI community were self-reported to the organization. Nearly 62% of those incidents were reported by women. A separate report from Stop AAPI Hate found that 26% of reported incidents against Asian American elders involved physical assault. This has resulted in Asian elders experiencing increased fear, stress, and anxiety since the pandemic. 98% of respondents say the United States has become more physically dangerous for Asian Americans. Communities are responding. They are doing such important work. So what is most effective, and what can society at large do to stop racism and violence against communities of color? Joining us are 3 guests. Cynthia Choi is one of 3 co-founders of Stop AAPI Hate, an organization founded in response to the alarming escalation in xenophobia and bigotry resulting from the COVID pandemic. Cynthia Choi is also co-executive director of Chinese for Affirmative Action, a 50-year-old community-based civil rights organization based in San Francisco. Hi, Cynthia. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you back. August Nimps is a professor of political science and African American and African studies at the University of Minnesota. Hi, Professor Nimps. Thank you so much for joining us again. Professor Nimps, are you with us?
To unmute. Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's great to have you again.
Thank you.
We are also joined by Marissa Limon Garza, Senior Director for Advocacy and Programming at the Hope Border Institute, an organization that works to build justice and deepen solidarity across the borderlands. Hi, Marissa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Well, Marissa, I want to start off with you. It's just shocking to think about what we've gone through the last 2 weeks, what the communities of Buffalo and Uvalde are going through right now. What kind of conversation do you think we need to be having right now? And I hate to say, I've been asking this so many times over the years, but what conversation should we have at this point?
Thank you for the question. I think the conversations that really need to be had right now are very direct and pointed, and they're about reckoning with white supremacy and its role in our nation and the perpetuation of this state and base of power, because all of these actions are intimately linked to that root cause. And so if we don't name that and be ready to wrestle with that and reckon with that, then we are doomed to repeat this. And unfortunately, it's communities of color, Black, Indigenous communities that are going to bear the brunt as they have since the beginning of this country. And so until we get to that point and see how everything is systematically aligned, whether we want to see that or not, we really don't have that luxury anymore. Too much blood has been spilt, too many lives have been lost, too many people have been harmed. And it really doesn't matter who is, it doesn't require a white person, quote unquote, to uphold white supremacy. This is a country that systems are built on white supremacy, and communities of color also knowingly, unknowingly, also support systems of white supremacy. And so how are we collectively having deep conversation, and how are we addressing it? And as an extension of that, how are we building practices of community? Because ultimately it's people, our relationship to one another, our human experience, our connectivity on this planet and in this country that I think will be the lifeblood. I mean, that's what we've seen from Buffalo is community, people, neighbors coming together. We've seen that in the Asian community, people coming together to back up one another and to not be harmed. We've seen that in all the places where we've seen gun violence, where community has come together. We've seen that through COVID and mutual aid. It's not the government that's coming to rescue us, it's one another. And so how are we building that community in small ways, intentionally every day, and having these difficult conversations that wrestle with white supremacy?
Thank you for that. That is Marissa Limon Garza, Senior Director for Advocacy and Programming at the Hope Border Institute. Professor Nimps, what would you add? What does the conversation need to sound like right now?
Well, first, again, thanks for inviting me to be a part of this discussion. I think, and at least this is what I try to do in the classroom and talking to community groups, is the importance of people having a historical perspective on racism, where it comes from, and what are the conditions under which it is it developed, why it surfaces at sometimes as opposed to others. In other words, to step back a little bit and to understand its history. And it's my contention that racism is a form of social inequality whose basis is class inequality. And if we look back and at the history of a racist hierarchy in the United States, I think that's very clear. So I tried to get people to think about history, putting things in historical perspective. Sometimes we get caught up so much in the present, we oftentimes fail to understand how change has come about, and change, and the importance of change, and under what circumstances change comes about.
That is August Nimps, Professor of Political Science and African American and African Studies at the University of Minnesota. Cynthia Choi is one of three co-founders of Stop AAPI Hate. Cynthia, what would you add?
Well, I couldn't agree more that we obviously have to look at this as systemic and structural. What we're witnessing now is that, you know, hate is on the rise for all communities of color. And this historically has been the case. And I think if we recognize to the point of understanding our history, that this is actually not unprecedented, it actually defines our experiences, that if you look at the history of racist rhetoric, that fueling policies and being justification for dehumanizing, criminalizing members of our community. And the fact that today, I think what's different is that this hate has been normalized. And we are seeing elected officials and candidates doubling down on this as a winning political strategy to mobilize their base. The Great Replacement theory is really recycled anti-immigrant, anti-people of color theories to paint us as an existential threat, whether it's a public health crisis, economic or national security. And we also know that what's also different is the level of misinformation and disinformation that's not only creating an environment where racist ideology is spread at such a rapid pace, it's also inciting violence. And what we're witnessing during this period is one of the extreme manifestations of individuals taking it upon themselves to address what they think is an existential threat. And that's leading to mass violence. So those are things that I think are perhaps different than in prior periods of where we've seen particular groups being scapegoated, targeted, and attacked.
Cynthia, to your point about politicians, as you say, a lot of these Republican politicians are doubling down on this. There's a state senator in Arizona, Wendy Rogers, who calls immigrants invaders who are swarming the border, bringing disease and crime. Of course, we know how Donald Trump started his campaign. And I'm sorry we have to even use this language, but by calling Mexicans rapists. This state senator Rogers tweeted or regularly tweets about this great replacement theory. We're being replaced and invaded. So given, and that's just one example of so many we can cite, but given this is coming from the top, from these politicians, how should this be dealt with? And what is the media's role when we hear this kind of racist language from politicians?
Well, in addition to condemning it, anytime any group is being targeted or scapegoated, naming it as racist and naming it as a source of the attacks against our community members, we need to hold elected officials accountable. We also have to deplatform major spreaders of this type of racist demagoguery. Again, that's putting targets on our backs. The fact that we have community members who don't feel safe going to the grocery store, going to their places of worship, going to school, walking on the sidewalk to take care of their daily needs. This is a national crisis, and it really deserves our attention. And I think that there are ways, obviously, as individuals, we need to vote. We need to make sure that we have our elected officials representing all of our interests. And in terms of the role of the media, we really have to point to what the drivers of this hate is. And I think that as long as we focus on the fact that these are individual actors, that it's really about mental health, and not really getting to the fact that we have a movement that is growing, that has been legitimized and normalized and given a platform to really spread these types of lies, that again has put a target on our backs, is something that we all need to be concerned about.
Exactly. I mean, really putting a target on our backs when you think about the El Paso shooter and the Buffalo shooter, who both embraced the racist great replacement theory. Marissa, what would you add? What should the response be to politicians, and how do you think the media should deal with this? And also social media companies.
Yeah, everybody. We all have skin in this game, and we have legacy media outlets that are also results of systemic institutions and are longstanding. And while the media is an incredibly important part of a democracy, and a healthy one at that, it is important to recognize that the kind of investigations, the kind of journalism, the kind of reporting, the kind of insight that's needed is also reflective of the community that you are reporting on. And so as long as we have corporate models where clickbait is what results in eyeballs and what results in, you know, the capitalist engine of the media running, then we'll have situations where scapegoating and targeting is profitable. And where you have those quick stories, it's no wonder if it bleeds, it leads is a saying for a reason. And so for us, it's really holding out a perspective of having really intentional, thoughtful people on boards of media companies, and also for those people to be hiring journalists that have lived experiences and backgrounds and sophistication and wisdom they can bring to the reporting that's nuanced and reflective of these communities to have a more deliberative dialogue. Oftentimes, especially here in the borderland, things get watered down into binaries very quickly. And it's a line in the sand. It's good, bad, it's right, wrong. We don't have a lot of space for nuanced conversation and for a deeper analysis because it's on to the next. And so really making sure that the media is doing a very deliberate job of that. Also, the media, you know, I see here locally, local broadcasts can be one of the highest influencers for what people see. Yes, they tune in to Fox News or to CNN, but oftentimes it's our local outlets that are actually more neighborly and associative for people on broadcast, and they will use stock footage from some of our enforcement agencies, from the Border Patrol, from ICE, from Customs. And they're not necessarily bad, quote unquote, but they only paint a limited picture. And sometimes we have journalists to just parrot back whatever the enforcement agencies are saying, and instead of having a thoughtful dialogue. And then on the flip side, I would offer something that we're working on, which is really taking a look at mis and disinformation that's targeting our communities, in particular Spanish language content that is deliberately trying to influence and inform how people view the world, whether it be with COVID and vaccine access, but also when it comes to voting and to civic engagement and participation. And so we have to be mindful that there's also nefarious actors at play. There's ways that we get our information that is definitely word of mouth because of lack of trust in larger institutions at times. And that can be shared on social media, that can be shared on WhatsApp and other channels, and people take it and it spreads very quickly. But unless our community has a thoughtful approach to how they're consuming media and how they're being presented, then we're going to end up having real barriers to how we can advance and address some of these challenges.
Professor Nimps, what would you add?
Well, as I said, I try to bring a historical perspective, and that historical perspective is also personal. I'm a 79-year-old African-American male. I grew up under the Jim Crow era in New Orleans, and I saw white supremacy at its height. And the kinds of issues and struggles that we're dealing with today can learn from those experiences and how we were able to push back the white supremacists, the politicians. We had politicians much more blatantly racist than is the case today. We had a president a century ago, Woodrow Wilson, the only PhD to ever be in the White House. Yeah, he led white supremacy at the national level from the White House, and at the local level that was the case. And we were able to push back those efforts and what those individuals stood for through mass mobilizations. The civil rights movement had the privilege of participating in that. And we also, more recently, we should remember today actually is the 2-year anniversary of the first George Floyd protest here in the Twin Cities. I had the privilege of attending that protest, and it was a multiracial protest, thousands of people taking to the streets. And one of the things I think the racist hate is exactly the kinds of multiracial protests that have been mm-hmm. taking place. And I try to get my daily dose of Tucker Carlson in, and I've been watching him for over 4 years. And you could see the anger on his face when he saw these mass protests 2 years ago. It's exactly the thing that he fears the most. And what his side represents is an effort for us to go back to the so-called good old days when white supremacy really was in power, and to play the divide and rule card as forces like that have always played, and to scapegoat and do all the things that they've always done. And so, again, I want to emphasize the importance of looking back at history, the victories that we won, how we did it, the mass mobilizations, multiracial mobilizations that exist today. We weren't able to do that in the 1960s. Anti-police brutality protests were almost exclusively African-Americans. With the George Floyd protests, indicated the opportunities we have today to build real mass multiracial mobilizations. And that's the way we will push back the racist forces. That's the way we did it in the South.
Professor Nimes, I remember we had you on the show. You wrote a piece about the multiracial actions that we were seeing all across the country in small towns a lot of people had never heard of. You had so many white people coming out onto the streets. When you look back at that massive moment and movement, what are your thoughts? What did it accomplish? And what are your thoughts about that movement and where it is today? And then if you can also elaborate on the backlash, because that's also so important.
Sure. Yeah, I think one of the most concrete results of the mass protests 2 years ago were reflected in the jury decisions. These are all virtually all white jury decisions of three police here in the Twin Cities, with the conviction of a majority white jury of Derek Chauvin. Then also in the Twin Cities with Daunte Wright's killer, who was also convicted by a almost exclusively white jury here in the Twin Cities. And Georgia was especially significant, the conviction of the killers of Ahmaud Arbery. Very significant in Georgia, believe me. Georgia, this was to find whites guilty of killing a black person, that was unheard of. That was unheard of during the height of during the height of white supremacy. So I'm convinced that these jury convictions, certainly in the case of the two cops who were convicted by these almost all white jurors here in the Twin Cities, that I think is perhaps one of the most concrete expressions of where the results of the mass mobilizations denounced the murder of George Floyd. That's just the other aspects to the mobilizations and so on. But I think concretely, I think that's an important gain that we should recognize.
What are your thoughts about the push to rehabilitate police departments? Because a lot of people say there were so many promises made, and once again, the politicians have not come through.
Sure. That's the case here. And what happened in the Twin Cities with the mass mobilizations, there were some people on the city council, some of whom I knew personally. One of them was a former student. And the problem is that they raised this defunding of the police without actually raising it with the communities and discussing it with working class communities and people who are experiencing another form of violence that we really should have an honest discussion about. And I'm referring to the recent FBI figures that were released 2 years ago, it was 2020, almost 10,000 African Americans, no, 12,000, close to 12,000 African Americans were killed, homicide by other African Americans. And it's that reality that made it difficult to tell working class communities that we don't need the police. And the reality is, under capitalism, you will need the police, because capitalism breeds a lot of bad actors. And so, yes, these reforms really ran up against the reality of what it means to organize, to police a society where there are deep, deep inequalities, racial inequalities, and other social inequalities, in reality of the police and how the police operate in such a society.
Marissa, what would you add when you look back at the George Floyd, the movement that was sparked by George Floyd's murder, and how so many people got involved in this? How are you reflecting on that, and what was accomplished, and where we are today?
It really, it was such a visceral response that so many people had. And I think because of the painful reality of being able to watch and consume a video, as awful as that was, it really galvanized a multiracial response in a way that was led in many instances by young people hungry for change and frustrated with the status quo and ready to collaborate and to partner. What's tricky is we're often building the airplanes as we're flying them in some of this justice movement and in the work and mobilization. And so it takes a lot out of our leaders and it takes a lot out of organizations to be able to continue the drumbeat. And people have been steadfastly committed, but we still need opportunities for people who are working 2 and 3 jobs to make ends meet, worrying about their kids' education, trying to just survive and hopefully thrive in this country, for them to be able to plug in meaningfully as well. And there needs to be spaces for people to continue to do that good work from wherever they are and not be fearful of being, called out or being excluded for maybe their lack of knowledge, that maybe there's a baby step that someone can take. And we want to set up processes so that people can feel like their movement in this direction is of value and can be a contribution. And so that's where it really goes back to having intentional conversation and searching for understanding and dialogue with one another. I'll often tell groups, this people come to see the work at the southern border and that's beautiful and it's a particular context. And the reality is that the border is everywhere in the United States. And we have to begin to have solidarity with one another by having conversations around the kitchen table that may be really difficult, with intergenerational dialogue, with maybe with our grandparents that maybe view things differently than we do, with our neighbors and coworkers. And I'm really thinking about white allies and the things that they can do in the spaces that they occupy, and really taking it to heart that part of this movement, part of this legacy, part of the legacy of George Floyd and in the spirit of his life and not just his death, is really that commitment to breaking down the barriers that divide us and have meaningful human-to-human connection, and to not just fall into the pits of being excessive on either end of the spectrum, but trying to find some kind of understanding as to why so-and-so may think a certain thing and why do I think a certain thing, and try to seek that understanding.
Hmm. Such a great point. Cynthia, what would you add before we go to break?
Well, I think that it was a galvanizing moment, but, I just want to say that there were others before George Floyd and there have been others since. I think that this is a moment where, again, we really need to interrogate this understanding of what is really going to make us safe. And I think this has been a moment for us to call for the kinds of investments in our communities that truly are going to address the needs of victims and survivors, to address the fears, the legitimate fears that our community members have. And it also really speaks to the fact that we have laws in place, protections in place, where people actually don't know what their rights are, where to go to get support. These are the kinds of things that we are working on every day. We're trying to turn this moment into a conversation about these strategies that, again, are truly going to address our safety concerns. And fundamentally, we have to start with an honest conversation about people's needs, basic needs being met. That part of the drivers around hate, violence, has to do with those root causes. And we are, again, trying to turn this moment into critical conversations about what we can do about that.
Cynthia Choi is one of three co-founders of Stop AAPI Hate and co-executive director of Chinese for Affirmative Action. August Nimps is a professor of political science and African-American and African studies at the University of Minnesota. And Marissa Limon Garza is senior director for advocacy and programming at the Hope Border Institute. Today, we are talking about what we all can do to stop racism and violence against communities of color. You can join us at 866-798-8255. We're also talking about media responsibility, the media's responsibility. You can email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll discuss how the media are framing the gun violence epidemic in the U.S. We got here because of Republican obstructionism. That is just a fact. And the money that they accept from the powerful gun lobby. And yet we constantly hear about gridlock and how broken things are in D.C. on this issue. So who's getting it right? We'll also discuss new reporting about how the Uvalde, Texas shooter was able to stay in the school for up to an hour. Really tragic videos are coming out about how parents responded when they got to the school. And we will talk about that tomorrow. The AP has been doing great reporting, so you can find those pieces online. Today, we are talking about how communities are responding to hate crimes and violence. What is most effective? What are your thoughts about where we are and how we should respond? What can society do to stop racism and violence against communities of color, a number of communities in our society? 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Marissa Limon Garza, Senior Director for Advocacy and Programming at the Hope Border Institute. They work to build justice and deepen solidarity across the borderlands. August Nimps is Professor of Political Science and African-American and African Studies at the University of Minnesota. Cynthia Choi is one of three co-founders of Stop AAPI Hate, an organization founded in response to the alarming escalation in xenophobia and bigotry resulting from the COVID pandemic. Let's talk about specifics, just about what communities are facing where you all are and the work that you do. Cynthia, you talked earlier about how some people are afraid to even go outside. And I just want to quote Lawrence from one of your recent reports. Lawrence said, quote, "Since the pandemic started, my neighbor's attitude toward me has escalated to the point where I had to file a protection order to make him stop with his constant violent rage and use of racial slurs. I've also been verbally assaulted while trying to buy groceries. I have not seen my grandson, who is afraid to come over to our home because of my neighbor's verbal threats. Things have gotten so bad, I refuse to go out unless it's absolutely necessary. I'm retired, former military. I feel like I'm back in school with racist bullies to defend myself once again. All of this has brought back bad memories, and now I'm severely depressed." Cynthia, how common is this sentiment?
Well, you know, what we've been able to establish nationally is that this is actually quite common. It is pervasive and systemic. We've received reports from all 50 states. And of course, the most of our incident reports are actually coming from California and other states where we have significant API populations. Unfortunately, this is quite common. And what's notable is that a majority of the incidents that we receive, these are self-reports, are actually not hate crimes. They are traumatic and harrowing and has created terror and fear amongst community members, especially our most vulnerable. And the fact that we have, you know, over 60% of our respondents being women, which suggests to us that, of course, we know that women and other vulnerable populations are subjected to harassment at much greater rates than men. And so this is something that I think is really important to note, that we have traditionally viewed safety in a very narrow way, that exclusively relying on law enforcement as a solution. And I think what we're trying to do as an example in California is to take a much broader approach that really gets at underlying causes of why our community members are being targeted, and really centering that on education and understanding how people are being impacted, whether they're going to the grocery store or taking public transit or merely just walking on the sidewalk. This is something that we've really normalized in our culture, and it's really high time that we address it much more systematically, in that, you know, government, community-based organizations, we all have a role in that. And I think it's something that we are very committed to, which is pursuing non-carceral approaches to what we see as a significant issue that our community is facing at this moment.
Professor Nimes, what would you add? I mentioned the Washington Post poll that found 3/4 of Black people in the U.S. are worried that they or someone they love will be attacked because of their race. What are you hearing from your community in Minnesota and from your students?
Well, yeah, as I mentioned before, the one of the concerns here within the African-American community is the problem of intra-communal violence, that is, people shooting and killing one another within the African-American community, and how to deal with that. It's the problem not only in Minneapolis, as I mentioned, but it's a problem nationally. And one of the things I try to emphasize to people is that during the civil rights movement, we have research which reveals that when people were mobilizing in the streets and the mass protests and so on, the intra-communal violence, the so-called black-on-black violence, diminished. The oppression that was internalized, is oftentimes internalized within the community, was able to be released in a constructive fashion. And so, yes, that's the biggest problem that that we face here, is how to deal with the intra-communal violence without having to resort to the police. And there are no easy answers to that. Malcolm X was asked once near the end of his life by a reporter what his program was all about. And he was asked by a reporter, are you trying to wake up African-Americans to their oppression? And his response was, no, I'm not trying to do that. They already know they oppress. I'm trying to wake them up to their self-worth. And that's really the challenge that we face. And a lot of these killings and so on take place because people feel disrespected, and that disrespect and this being dismissed is the result of a low sense of self-worth. And that low sense of self-worth is a product of the larger capitalist reality in which African-Americans as working people and other working people face. And the COVID, and the COVID-19 lockdown did not help things.
Right. How do your students talk about these issues?
Well, the students talk about it in all kinds of different ways. The question of the biggest challenge I have, as I said, is just trying to get them to step out of the present a little bit and think about things in historical perspective. Mm. And again, I have the advantage of having seen the kinds of changes that have taken place. Exactly because of the protests, the historical protests. And so my biggest task is to try to get them to think about the opportunities that we have today in order to fight back, in order to resist the racist, the possibilities for building real multiracial coalitions to push back the backlash, to push back against the racists and so on. Those opportunities, they tend not to be aware of or tend not to know about or then tend to take them for granted. And my task is to try to help them to think about the big picture and to see ourselves as a part of something larger, just not our local communities and so on, but we are part of something larger and of historical importance.
And Marissa, in the Latino community, when you think about what happened under the Trump administration, the rise in reports of hate crimes reached an all-time high. There was so much fear. What has changed? When you look back at what communities were facing then and now, how do you think about the changes?
So I think a lot of folks held out a lot of hope for the Biden administration, at least and our top leaders in the country, elected leaders, changing their tune, which has happened. I think about in response to the El Paso massacre, President Trump came to El Paso to offer his condolences, and what a stark difference that was when President Biden went to Buffalo and made remarks. And it's dramatic. We know that not only is the president the commander-in-chief, but they also set a tone in many ways for how we will respond and how we will walk with one another. And so it's imperative that the rhetoric that comes from the top, whether good or bad, favorable or not, scapegoating or not, has an impact. And so we have seen a definite shift in tone from the administration, and that makes a difference. However, on the ground, things are still challenging. Things are still difficult. And I think for many people, the twin incidents, the lives lost in Buffalo at a grocery store, very similar to the Walmart here in El Paso, and the lives lost at a prominent, predominantly Latino, Latinx elementary school by another Latino young person. It's a lot to bear, and it's a lot to witness. And what a lot of people haven't really reported on as much is how some of the parents of the children in Uvalde are undocumented in their mixed status households. And the fact that the shooter, at least the last time I saw, was allegedly shot by a Border Patrol official, makes things even more complicated, but is reflective of the realities that we exist in. And so it's that nuance that comes to mind. And so while the rhetoric may have changed from the top in our loudest platform, it's also still reckoning with the realities on the ground that that rhetoric from the past administration is still alive and well. It just may not have the same bully pulpit, and the ramifications are still being felt by all of us.
I think so many people, Marissa, when they first heard about it, immediately thought another white supremacist. And then, as you said, I was just reading this column by Gustavo Arellano from the LA Times, "A Latino on Latino Mass Shooting, What Now?" And it's, like you say, it's a really intense thing to grapple with.
I would offer that it's tempting to admonish anyone who takes on that kind of act of violence, and some would say, you know, evil, so to speak. And I have to remember, and I really am trying to understand this young man who had just turned 18, in the eyes of the law, an adult, I guess, to an extent, what we know about child development, 18, you're still developing a lot of your brain and prefrontal cortex. The fact that he was living with his grandmother, I don't know where his parents are. And I don't necessarily ascribe blame. I'm trying to understand, and I feel like if we peel back the layers, we're going to see additional evidence of systems of oppression at play. Whereas what are the conditions for a parent not to parent. I think that's not the standard. That's something extraordinary. And yet in our community, there are many, many grandparents raising their grandchildren. And there's many times where here in the state of Texas, where I live, we make it easy for the kind of rage and acts of violence to escalate to mass murder by making guns so accessible. And so we are not helping the situation that may be the result of a systemic challenge. Maybe it is other things at play, but then we arm that and we let that fester.
Right, right. The Washington Post spoke with friends of this 18-year-old and said he was bullied as a child, just nonstop. He had a stutter. And then reportedly, his mom had a drug problem. And so he had a difficult home life, which just speaks to what you laid out. And we're actually going to do a show about a young person like this shooter and what he has dealt with and, you know, society the falling through the cracks, someone like this person falling through the cracks. And then, as you said, able to get an AR. And then a completely different story, the shooter, the Buffalo shooter, who is a self-described white supremacist and anti-Semite. And to talk about, you know, given that these guns are so readily available, how do we reach these people? Because we have to talk about that. We have an email from a listener who just wanted to thank you all for the work you're doing and says, what a breath of fresh air to hear about the work you're doing to engender love and understanding across racial lines. So can we end by just talking about this? What is really working when you talk about understanding and coming together? And like you say, Professor Nimps, putting together a multiracial coalition to do this work. Professor Nimps, what are your thoughts on what actually works given your historical perspective here?
Well, again, I'll just to repeat what happened with the George Floyd protest, the multiracial mass character of them, is testimony to the kinds of changes that have taken place and the opportunities that we have today. Reporters would ask me at times about whether or not what a protest due to the fact that the murder was captured on camera. And I say, yeah, that was probably the case. But then I began to think about it. Just because something is on camera doesn't necessarily lead to outrage. As you all know, in California in 1992 with Rodney King, that was also captured on camera. But the jury exonerated the police. And since 1992, however, jurors are doing something different. And I think it reflects, that is, all white jurors are doing, deciding differently. And I think it reflects the kinds of changes that have taken place within society, the opportunities we have, in other words, to reach out and to build multiracial coalitions, the kind of multiracial coalitions that someone like Tucker Carlson is doing everything he can to make sure does not happen. And so we need to think about what's the best way to do that, to build those coalitions and be aware of the opportunities that we have today to do that.
Cynthia Choi, final thoughts from you. We have about a minute left.
Yeah, we just have to believe that change is possible when we're united against hate and violence. And that has always been the center of our multiracial movement. This has been a challenging time, but it's been an opportunity for us to develop a shared understanding of what the root causes are and what's truly going to make us safe. And that is really centering the experiences of victims and survivors and really focusing on the prevention. How do we address misinformation, disinformation, and the spread of racist ideology that's leading to violence, mass violence? This is something that doesn't just affect those who are being targeted. It affects all of us.
Cynthia Choi is one of three co-founders of Stop AAPI Hate and co-executive director of Chinese for Affirmative Action. August Nimps is professor of political science and African American and African Studies at the University of Minnesota. Marissa Limon Garza is senior director for advocacy and programming at the Hope Border Institute. Thank you all so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Students Demand Action called for a student walkout today, and I'm just looking at their Twitter feed. Wow, this is incredible. Students from across the country are walking out of classes, just started in the last 3 hours and is happening as we're speaking right now, to demand action on some kind of gun control. Uvalde, Texas, Rhode Island, it looks like about 100 students are actually laying on the ground. What will it take, they said. Missouri, another one in Uvalde, Virginia. This is just happening all across the country. St. Charles, Missouri, students are walking out of class to demand action. And we will bring you an update on this tomorrow on our media roundtable. We'll talk about how the media are framing the gun violence epidemic in the United States. We got here because of Republican obstructionism and the money they take from the powerful gun lobby. So who's getting it right? We will also talk about new reporting about how the Uvalde, Texas shooter was able to stay in the school for up to an hour. Thanks to B. Saul for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And you can find a number of links about the topics that we discussed today at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.